Turkey has been carrying out airstrikes on the autonomous Rojava region in northeast Syria. According to some observers, these attacks are a significant escalation of the conflict between Turkey and the autonomous Kurdish region. Arthur Pye is with the Emergency Committee for Rojava. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg.
You wanted to just say a little bit about what Rojava is, so why don't you do that?
Absolutely, thanks. So Rojava is an autonomous zone in north and east Syria, which is governing itself on the basis of some core principles being local-based direct democracy, women's liberation, ecology, and cultural pluralism. And this region is now governing a third of Syrian territory and a third of its people. But it's really an anti-state, grassroots, democratic style of administration, self-administration, as they call it.
That some have called a utopia, even.
Some have used it. I think it's inspired very much by like utopian traditions, but those who've been on the ground know that that's not how real life works. Of course, it's a place facing a lot of hardships, a lot of challenges, has its own problems, but is an incredibly inspiring example of a vision for and kind of practical experiments with structures of self-governance that point towards a fundamentally more democratic and just society. Absolutely.
But the Turks are not fond of it, and they've launched these attacks. Are these attacks specifically against the PKK, or are they really affecting most of Rojava?
Yes, it's true that the Turkish state views the revolution, the democratic revolution in northeast Syria, as a threat to its own power, as a threat to its own like Turkish nationalist ideology, you could say. And it's true that it's using the PKK as a pretext. For those who don't know, the PKK is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, is a Kurdish organization that has been fighting an insurgency within Turkey since the 80s, really. And so when Turkey attacks northeast Syria, it says it's attacking the PKK. Most recently, it's used the pretext of saying a recent attack in Ankara, which did occur, and which the Kurdistan Workers' Party did claim responsibility for. This was an attack that injured two police officers outside of the Interior Department in Ankara. Turkey falsely claimed that there's a direct connection between this attack and northeast Syria, without providing any evidence, of course, and proceeded to bomb civilian infrastructure and even explicitly claim that it is targeting what it calls YPG infrastructure. Now, the YPG are the People's Protection Units. It's a Kurdish-led force, in many ways inspired directly by the same philosophy that the PKK is rooted in, but with its own autonomous, distinct organizations. Of course, this is happening in Syria, not in Turkey. So what Turkey's done is it's started bombing the basic vital infrastructure of this region to really try to attack the revolution by essentially trying to make the region unlivable by terrorizing the society itself. So what has it done? It's bombed and destroyed electrical facilities, oil wells, factories, food facilities, water facilities, and literally hospitals. Two hospitals, we think, by now. Of course, the information is still coming in. It's a very chaotic situation on the ground. People can look to the Rojava Information Center for like more detailed update analysis. But these are all very serious war crimes, and unfortunately, they're being carried out with support from the United States. Turkey receives very reliable, not only political support, but concrete military support from the United States. These bombs are being dropped by F-16s that are made in the United States and drones that are made partly by drone parts, components from the United States as well.
But then the U.S. has, what, about 1,000 troops in the area, and they're supposed to be cooperating with the Kurds to fight ISIS. So what's going on there?
This is true. It's another good question. It's, of course, a large, messy topic, which we don't have time to get in the weeds on. But essentially, it's true there's about 900 U.S. troops in Syria. They've been there for many years. The relationship between the Kurdish-led, what's now called this larger umbrella of the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is not just Kurdish forces, but air forces and other democratic forces. The relationship between the U.S.-led coalition and this SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces, is focused specifically on operations against ISIS, right? So famously, the SDF, with the support of U.S. airstrikes, defeated ISIS territorially, although ISIS remains a threat that carries out basically sleeper cell attacks, right? Like it hides in society, carries out attacks on civilians and other military targets. And the U.S. is still working with the SDF in operations against ISIS, but it is not doing anything to support the SDF when it gets attacked by Turkey. Of course, Turkey is a NATO member. And all the while, the U.S. is giving this limited form of military support to the SDF against ISIS. It is not lifting a finger to push back Turkey and hold it accountable and stop it from carrying out these attacks. As I mentioned earlier, Turkey's doing this with direct support from the U.S. and from NATO more broadly.
This is happening on Syrian territory. What's the position of the Syrian government?
So the Syrian government is no friend of the Kurds going back before the Syrian civil war.
But the Kurds aren't really trying to overthrow Assad.
Right.
They're sort of staying out of that.
It's true. It's complicated, right? So the Syrian civil war came out of a popular uprising calling for the overthrow of the Assad regime. And while the
Kurds, least reform.
Right. Well, it called for reform and then it ended up calling for overthrow after a very violent, very brutal crackdown. But this conflict very quickly escalated and it militarized and it fractured. And what happened was what's called this sort of so-called opposition is still largely dominated by, or now largely dominated by, jihadist Islamist and Arab nationalist groups that do not support Kurdish rights. And the Kurds and their kind of democratic-minded allies in their region kind of forge what they call a third way. So they're not demanding an independent state. They're not demanding the overthrow of the Assad regime outright. They don't want more civil war. What they're calling for is the democratization and the decentralization of power within all of Syria, but especially within the region that they reside. So they want their autonomy to be respected. They have their own form of self-governance, which has to do with these grassroots neighborhood communes, which they call them, federating all the way up to this very innovative kind of feminist democratic structure. They want to spread these ideas all over Syria. And the regime, of course, what's their position? They don't like this one bit. They're an Arab nationalist authoritarian regime. They want to control their territory once again, but they can't afford to do it. So basically, they're no friends, but at the same time, the movement in Rojava is facing much more direct, immediate threats from ISIS and from the Turkish state. So in the relationship with the regime, it's more tentative. The regime at times blockades supplies from making it into the autonomous region, but rarely directly attacks them. They're scattered skirmishes, but it can be seen as sort of like this third level threat, which is not as immediate.
And have the Syrian forces ended up fighting the Turkish forces?
There are conflicts along these lines. It's mostly indirectly. What I mean by that is that the Turkish state directly supports what we call the opposition, right? So in places like Idlib, for example, in the far west of Syria, the Syrian state is directly fighting different factions of the opposition, almost all of which are completely dominated by various Islamist groups that are supported directly and some more indirectly by the Turkish state. Sometimes Turkey bombs positions of the Syrian state and kills regime soldiers, but it's more an indirect conflict. And there's also been attempts by Erdogan, the Turkish president, to achieve some sort of dialogue or truce with the regime against the autonomous region in Rojava. But it's a very complicated, delicate dance. None of these larger nation states like the idea of people governing themselves for obvious reasons. But what they can do about it at various times depends on this kind of delicate, dynamic balance of forces in this very complicated war.
And speaking of complications, the Russians and the Iranians are in there too, right?
Mm. Yeah, so that's very true. Russia and Iran both are allies of the Syrian regime. Much of the gains, or at least sort of momentum that the Syrian regime has had in holding back the opposition, has for a large part been due to Russian support in the form of air power. But it's true. I spent time on the ground in northeast Syria. I recently returned from a year there where I did research and worked as a journalist. And, you know, depending on where you are, you see regularly, you will see Russian military patrols. Some places you will see American military patrols. And there are even pockets that are controlled by at least, I would say, militias that are directly connected to and supported by the Iranian state. But when you bring up Russia, another thing it makes me want to mention is that the conflict in Ukraine has had an influence by strengthening Turkey's position in its relationship with the United States. And why is that? Because Turkey is a member of NATO. And since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the United States and President Biden have been especially reluctant to hold Turkey accountable for anything, for its human rights violations at home and for its aggression against even U.S. allied forces within Syria.
So they treat Israel, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Right. So the movement in Rojava understands very well that the United States is not giving it military support against ISIS because it thinks that their revolution is really one wonderful, great thing. It's doing it out of their own self-interest, just like it does anywhere. But they need to survive. They have direct threats and they'll take support where they can get it sometimes when they're most desperate, just like anybody would. At the same time, there's a real doublespeak, no? Where on the one hand, the U.S. is arming, providing limited arms and training and coordination against Daesh, against ISIS, particularly in the south. And at the same time, it's just completely looking the other way as Turkey bombs those same allies, not just militarily, but commits blatant war crimes and violates the U.S. brokered ceasefire from 2019 as well, by carrying out these brutal attacks that are continuing in this very moment in northeast Syria against, again, hospitals, food and water facilities. These are not military targets. Even if they were, there'd be a violation of the ceasefire. And the United States is doing basically nothing. Right now, President Biden, what is he doing? He's calling on Congress to provide more F-16s to the Turkish state. Right now, more F-16s, brand new fleet of fighter jets, as well as modernization kits for their older fighter jets, the same jets that are carrying out these bombings, again, as we speak. Right now, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has the power to stop this sale. Bob Menendez, we all know there's been this whole scandal. He's the former chair. He's being indicted. He's no longer the chair of that committee. Now it's Ben Cardin, the senator from Maryland. Senator Cardin has kind of, in a general sense, has come out publicly criticizing Turkey's human rights record. At the same time, there's been some very concerning rhetoric, kind of saying things like, well, we're going to have to look at all the facts. I'm going to talk to the president. We'll do what makes the most sense. So right now, we're trying to raise the spotlight and the pressure on Senator Ben Cardin to do the right thing and to definitively commit publicly and explicitly to blocking this sale of F-16s to Turkey. U.S. weapons must not be given to a force to simply bomb civilians and carry out war crimes against our allies.
It sounds a little bit similar to the situation in Yemen, where the U.S. has been helping the Saudis.
It's true, yeah. This would not be the only example, right, in the world of the United States providing arms to foreign governments or their proxies as they carry out war crimes. We're all aware of us, especially those of us who come to this issue as people who are very politically sympathetic with the more radically progressive revolutionary politics of the project in Rojava. We understand that the U.S. has a long history of imperialist intervention against kind of democratic revolutions around the world. At the same time, we understand that from a pragmatic point of view, the U.S. already has a role in the region. And that means that what it does is of great consequence in the short term. In a material sense, real lives are at stake in real time. And so at the same time, we want to see the United States take a less aggressive role of intervening around the world in its own interests. We recognize that in the real world, it's there, it's on the ground, and we're going to call on it to take actions that would support the preservation of civilian life, the protection of human rights, and the survival of this example of grassroots democracy, which is frankly unprecedented in the region.
How is Rojava holding up right now? Are they able to survive?
Well, we can only hope. You know,
has the UN talked about this as a major humanitarian crisis at this point or not yet?
unfortunately, in the larger picture, the United Nations has not done nearly enough. When it comes to the UN brokered peace negotiations over the future of the Syrian conflict itself and that formal negotiation process, the US and the United Nations have failed to even secure a seat at the table for representatives of the autonomous administration. Again, this is the governing body and the defense forces of a third of Syria as we currently speak. And it's by far the most economically stable and democratic part of the country. They don't even have a seat at the table. The United Nations will only work as a matter of policy directly with the Syrian state because it is officially recognized as a state. You know, when it comes to how are people faring, how are they holding up, how are they doing on the ground? I've been talking every day lately with my friends on the ground, both Kurdish and Arab friends who I met in my time there, who call the region their home, as well as internationalist volunteers from all over the world that are involved in various projects there. And they're extremely concerned. For one, there's about 2 million people currently without electricity. Civilians are being obviously killed and injured in these attacks themselves. There's also a great fear that this damage is not even an end in and of itself, that Turkey sees this as laying the basis for a major ground invasion, where they will actually seek to, which they've done in the past, in Afrin in 2018, in Serikanye in 2019, they have launched major assaults that led to occupations that last to this day, massive ethnic cleansing, displacement of hundreds of thousands of Kurds and other ethnic minorities. People are really concerned that this is going to happen again. Turkey is saying explicitly, Erdogan is saying he wants to take the city of Tel Rifat. He wants to take the city of Minbij, the city of Kobani. These are strongholds of the Rojava revolution. These are places where people are struggling every day to create a grassroots, secular, pluralistic democracy that centers women's rights. And how does Turkey react? It wants to crush it by force. So people are extremely concerned. But lastly, I want to say, at the same time, these people are incredibly resilient. This is not the first hardship that they have faced. Not only have Kurds faced systematic oppression and violence and colonialism going back decades and centuries, but the movement there, no, these are the people that fought ISIS and defeated it territorially. These are people who have been building this structure of autonomy in spite of being not only attacked physically, but isolated economically, isolated politically. They're incredibly resilient people, and they have robust level of self-organization down to the community level, which makes them incredibly resilient. I was there earlier this year when the earthquake took place, and I traveled to Aleppo to see the aftermath and document it. And I got into an autonomous Kurdish majority neighborhood within Aleppo, which of course is a city largely dominated by the regime. But within this autonomous pocket, which is a part of the same revolution in the rest of northeast Syria and Rojava, you saw a place where, on the one hand, the regime wasn't even allowing, you know, we managed to get in as journalists, but at the same time, even a week, 2 weeks after the earthquake, the regime was not letting in blankets, medicine, food, water, heating gas, middle of winter, right? It's raining. People are out of their homes. At the same time, because of this grassroots kind of communalist society that they're building, they're incredibly resilient in the ways that they're able to respond, in ways that they're able to make sure that every single family in every neighborhood is accounted for, their needs are being met to the greatest extent possible, of course, within their material means. Person told me there, one of the co-chairs, which of course in every position of responsibility, according to their political program, there has to be at least one woman, right? It's a part of their idea of women's autonomy. The co-chair there, she told me, we may not have material things here, but at least here the people live with one heart, she said. You know, you could throw a stone across the street on the other side of the checkpoint where people are living under the regime, and they may have had access to more material aid, but they weren't getting the same kind of support because the community wasn't organized. So I think you could see it twofold, right? They're dealing with incredible hardship at the same time. Because of the revolution itself, they're even more resilient to facing these kinds of attacks.
That's Arthur Pye of the Emergency Committee for Rojava speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on October 19th, 2023.